Welcome back to Rude Dude.
Welcome to the Rude Dude Recovery Podcast with your host and resident wet brains, Cam and Hen, two dudes navigating the waves of wellness. Thanks for being here. In this week's episode, the dudes sit down with Jesse Vance, a Morgantown recovery staple. Jesse shares his incredible story and speaks on losing his mother to addiction, coping with anxiety, going to festivals sober, and learning to love himself. Stay tuned for some tasty nuggets on self-confidence. Please enjoy Season 2, Episode 5 of the Rude Dude Recovery Pod. I'm ringing down, down, down. And if I were you, where are you? I'd lay low. Welcome back to the Rude Dude Podcast. I am one of your host, Penny Lopes the Lobster, with my esteemed cohort and partner in crime, Cameron the Cree Davis. How are you there, Cree man?
Well, you know what, man? I'm actually, I'm in a good mood today, bro. Yes. It's been sunny as hell. If it's any indication as how rough the summer is going to be out here, it's 82 degrees already out here. I have the air conditioning on, but I do have a recent development. If you're a long time listener to this show, okay. Some people may remember me saying that I ditched Crocs for Hey Dudes, right? You remember this?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, dude. Well, I have now stepped into the next evolution of Croc reuniting. I copped some of the Gen Z fucking super Yeezy floppers, dude. And let me say, dude, they
some
are
dickhead they, was wearing those in the fucking gym tonight.
Dude, they are the shit, dude. Are so comfortable. I got roasted by my sister-in-law. She said I looked like a silly goose or something like that, dude. But they are fan fucking tastic, dude.
Did you schedule your perm yet?
Not yet, dude, but I'm in route, dude. I can put like 27 earrings in my gauged ear holes, so I'm already set there. How are you doing,
case,
bro?
In case the listener is curious, I still have never owned a pair of Crocs or Hey Dudes because here's the thing about it. I only exclusively wear sweatpants and sweatshorts and basketball shorts. Yeah. So I know the way I'm set up. If I put those motherfuckers on, dude, they're never coming off. I'll never wear another thing in my life. I just know. So
yeah, dude, I've been wearing these slides for the last like fucking 3 days straight. Like they don't come off. I wear them with my robe. I put them on with my clothes. I'm wearing them right now. I'll wear them when I take the dog out to take a piss at night. I would sleep in them if I could. They're that good, dude. But yeah, how are you doing, bro?
You could. I'm doing well, and I'm hyped for this episode. I'm excited because last week, the last 2 weeks, the vibes were low, and last week I promised the listeners that we would elevate the vibes. And I believe that I'm going to over deliver on that promise because we have a very special guest. So this man who I'm about to bring on, my buddy, Jesse, he is another Morgantown recovery fixture. He has, I believe, 9 years clean. We'll find out. But common to all the people that I bring on this show, he has the characteristics that I strive for. You know, one of those people that you see in recovery and you're like, damn, dude, I want what that guy's got. I want to be like him. So he sponsors people. He works in recovery. He's just an all around awesome dude. So I present to you Jesse Vance. What's up, baby boy?
What's up, y'all? Hey, first things first, I got to get this out the way, okay? Cam, I'm with you, bro.
Yay, there we go. There we go.
Dude. Wait, what?
This is the Vans ones, huh?
These are like the Vans Crocs.
Oh, I'll do that. I'll fucking do that.
I actually caught these something special out of a Vans outlet outside of LA last summer. So, holler. Hey. I'm looking California, but feeling West Virginia. You know what I mean?
Dude, I've been looking at those on the fucking Vans website, and I need a pair stat. There's some of those army green ones, and I'm just like, bro, Vans Crocs, dude. Now you want to talk
this
about something I'm never taking off?
Of bad footwear. This is you have to kill the Hey Dudes and all the other imposter Fugazi Croc slides to get dude. To this bad boy because the comfort levels off the chain.
Right, for the listeners, they are the checkerboard Vans tradition looking, but they're like the foam style and the checkerboard part is missing, like the holes, like Crocs.
Yeah, they're like Crocs.
So I was sitting here having that conversation with you about Crocs and Hey Dudes, and I felt bad that Jesse wasn't in here yet because I was like, I know this motherfucker is going to want to weigh in on this. I know he's got
yeah,
something.
Dude. You're the odd one out on this, man.
Yeah, big Hey Dude guy. But like Cam nailed it when he was like, we can do better. As dads, we deserve the top tier, you know, comfort experience. And I feel like that's what's being delivered with this footwear.
All right, dude.
Oh, man. I got to get some of these fucking goofy ass shoes. I don't know why.
I got these on a manager special for like $8. Something crazy. Yeah. It was obvious they weren't selling well, but I wasn't buying the hype. I'm like, I don't need to be cool. I need to be comfy. Yeah. Which makes me pretty fucking cool. I might say so myself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us into pretty much everything that I said in the intro. You know, I've always just admired that you are just you, and you're comfortable being yourself. And is that something that came with recovery, or is that more like you've kind of always been that way?
It's definitely a recent development. So I would say post recovery. I mean the level of, I always had the facade, you know, I always had that, my sponsor always tells me that like, I never have to worry about overreacting, but I always need to worry about underreacting. Because that's my MO, that's my coping mechanism, you know? And so really kind of embodying the internal to go with the image, the visual, that was something that came post recovery, you know, and it was a couple years in, man. It took some time. It took some steps. It took a lot of headaches, and to say, like, I guess I should back up to say, like, I don't feel comfortable in my skin all the time. That's not the case, man. Like, you know, anxiety still happens. Depression still happens. I'm still a person who lives with mental illness. And I'm just a person, you know, at the end of the day. So I experience those things. But you know, the mentality of, you know, y'all can't hurt me like that. That was something that like, I really, after like going through multiple court cases, after, you know, just, it seemed like in the beginning of my recovery, things were really stacked against me. And I got in that like defeatist kind of victim mentality of like, I got to this precipice sort of where it was like, I could either, you know, go on to the bitter end. Right. And that was the internal bitter end of what's the use? Why keep doing this? Why try when it feels like the world is going to continue just like beating me down? And it was actually my attorney at the time who said to do it out of spite, to live spitefully to everyone, all the naysayers, all the haters, all the judges that never thought I would, you know, show up clean or show up for court at all. You know, he was like, do it to spite them and, you know, live like you're pretending as if nothing bad could ever happen, you know, and then watch the results. And so I really, it was like a fake it till you make it kind of situation.
Yeah. So I remember you were unfortunately one of those people who got clean, but your past still had some catching up to you to do. So like, I think the first few years I knew you, you were like on ankle monitor and
constantly.
That's a tough thing for a lot of us. It reminds me of the Randall Brown. I'm sober now. Do you forgive me? No, motherfucker. You got warrants and shit. We don't forgive you. Like,
yeah, man.
And we see this where, and that has to be hard where like, okay, I'm clean now. I'm doing good. And it's like, yeah, but you still like committed those crimes you have to answer for. And it's really hard on people that are early in recovery to be like, oh, I did all this and they're still trying to get me. But, you know, it's we do have to deal with the wreckage of our past.
100%, dude. When I came in, it was, I already had, you know, when I decided to give recovery a try, it wasn't like I had this light bulb, you know, the clouds parted and the rainbows shined down and there was trumpets and shit. It was like, I had nothing better to do, right? I had nothing else to lose essentially, except my life. Right. And it was like a trial membership. I looked at it like a Netflix subscription where I was like, I'll give this a shot, but I'm still not sold, you know? And coming in, I only went to rehab because God help me, my girlfriend at the time told me if I ever wanted to see her again, that I would go to treatment. Right. And you can kind of fill in the blanks on that, because I was in jail for a directly substance use related crime. Right. But I was also at the point where I didn't want to keep making excuses. I had so many excuses that I had always fallen back on. And I was just talking about this in a group I did that, you know, excuses they stop being excuses when I decide. Right. And so now I can say that, you know, the trauma, the setbacks, the hurdles, the barriers, those were reasons that it took me as long to get to where I am today, you know, but they're not excuses for why I didn't take the steps. You know, excuses are things that stop me from doing what I need to do. Whereas reasons, you know, trauma, those barriers, those are exactly just that. It's a bump in the road. You know, it might be a stop sign. It might even be like a pull off spot, but it's not a brick wall. You know, none of those things were death sentences. And that all kind of ties back in with that. Like, you can't hurt me, dude. Like, there's nothing you can take from me that is like my treasures, because those are things that are inside me. Like, those are things I've had to cultivate, you know, the real gifts of like self. I don't like using self-acceptance a whole lot, because most days it's like self-tolerance. But those are the things that like, those are my real gifts, right? And like the setbacks and the court cases and all that shit, man, like that's all they were. You know, they were bumps in the road. But at the time, they really seemed like end of the world shit, for sure.
So before we get too off track here, can you just give me a quick synopsis on as to how you got to that point? Because we kind of jumped to like, you know, court cases and all that stuff. What was your jam? Heroin addict, alcoholic?
Yeah. So it was mostly, I grew up pretty common upbringing, you know, like that troubled youth type thing. My mom was one of us. she was a person that lived with substance use until she didn't, you know. And so I grew up with pretty much as long as I could remember, there was always something going on substance use wise. And I got into it at a pretty young age. You know, I started smoking and drinking, but I never really touched like the hard stuff until I was about 18. And I was a musician and I was like starting to play in bars, and, you know, I had a little band going, and we had this little record label thing that was just a joke looking back. But at the time it was like, we're rock stars and it's going to be this big thing. So we were playing bars, and so people wanted to keep us loaded, man. And I was under 21. So I was just stoked to be in the bar. And that lifestyle just, you know, it's fast paced, man. It's rode hard and hung up wet. And that's what happened. You know, I ended up, I ended up moving into this like hippie commune when I was about like 18. So I lived in this old church with a bunch of hippies. It was awesome. That was one of the best times in my life. Pre-recovery, and even big picture, it was just a great time.
Yeah.
Because we were just playing music nonstop, and we were going to festivals, and I got introduced to the Grateful Dead. So now I'm on tour, and I learned so much, you know, about like quality relationships. And, but I also learned a lot about substance use. You know, I learned a lot about that culture, and I lost sight of a lot of the cool things that I discovered about myself along the way. So I caught my first, well, technically the first time I ever got involved with the justice system, I was 12, just young, dumb kid stuff, you know, vandalism, hooliganism, shenanigans.
Hoop dickery.
Oh yeah. Tomfoolery to the max. And the first time I committed a big boy crime, you know, with that big F in front of it, was I was 18 or 19. It was right after my mom had passed. So my mom passed away in 2014. It wasn't a direct overdose, but it was kind of secondary to heroin use. You know, it was, she had an infection and sepsis, and, you know, she ended up taking a little too long to get to the hospital, and she ended up passing away while she was there. Mm-hmm. And, this was actually at a point in my life where I was homeless. I was homeless living on the streets of Uniontown, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I was sleeping on couches and just doing the dirt. You know, there was no fun at this point in my life. It was all just, I was tired, man. And I was tired of the running and gunning, and, you know, it was just not the vibe. So I decided to move back to California. to go live with my grandparents and kind of start over. And I wanted to go to Folsom Lake College for music, for sound engineering, and, you know, just kind of start my life at that point. Well, my mom decided she wanted to move out there too. She wanted a fresh start as well. And my grandma booked us both tickets. Well, when it came time to fly out, my mom had an infection. You know, she had an infection at one of her sites. And so she had to hang back. I ended up going to California. And about 3 weeks after I arrived to California and started kind of putting those pieces together, she passed. And for me, that was the catalyst. You know, that was my my Alamo, if you will. Like, that was just all bets were off. You know, it was full send, you know, and I developed this mentality of like, well, I'll try anything twice. And so that's what I did. But I had this mentality of, she died because of heroin use, and she did a lot of benzos. So for me, that took those off the table. I'm really grateful to say, like, I've never done heroin, and I am grateful to say that, you know. Mm-hmm. But I've experienced the same hell that a lot of my brothers and sisters that have, you know, had that experience, that they have. You know, I know what it's like to not be able to look in a mirror, just because of how, like, sick of myself I was. And so that's what happened, man. I caught my first charge in 2015, just not even a year after my mom had passed away. I caught, I think it was 13 possession with intents, to deliver a bunch of like possession charges, simple assault. I got in a fight with a girlfriend that just got way out of hand verbally. And, you know, it started leading toward that physical route. And she called the cops and was like, "Hey, he's got a backpack full of drugs and he's beating me up." And sure nice. Enough, they showed up, and I sure had that backpack full of. You know, so there I am. I think I was 18, 19. I don't know. I was young, and 19 or 20, something like that. And I'm in jail for the first time, looking at, I don't even know how much time. If you stacked them all up, it was like 18 to 30 years or something crazy like that. And by the grace of God, or by the curse of the devil, I don't know which way it went, I got bonded out, and I was given, you know, the second chance. My stepdad,
who bonded you? Oh,
my stepdad. Yeah, he bonded me out. He was my dad. That's, you've heard me share about him, Henry. He's the one that you know, passed away a couple of years ago of cancer. But we were estranged for a long time. My mom and him split up when I was young. And we sort of stayed in touch, but it was more or less, I would come around if I needed something, and he would always give it to me. And so that was, you know how we do, man.
What about biological?
Not in the picture.
Sperm donor.
Never knew him. Never knew. My mom was a bit of a party animal, if you will. And, you know, she liked to get down. She liked to have a good time in all senses of the word. And so, over the years, she gave me, I think, 3 or 4 different possible names, which, if you remind me later, I'll tell you. I have a...
So you were almost named Whisper Breeze?
I was almost named Zachary, but I got all kinds of weird stories about that. I have an Elvis story that I'm happy to share at any point, but it's kind of a rabbit hole thing. but yeah, that was... you know, that was the point. My dad bonded me out, and I just went right back to it, man. I thought, you know, he wanted me to stay with him, and he's like, "I'll put you to work. I'll keep you on the straight and narrow." And I was like, "Yeah,
sounds lame."
Yeah, probably not, you know. And I went and hid out in the mountains. I thought, if I just get away from everybody and everything, it was just me, one guy, and a bunch of chickens, just absolute nothingness. And that didn't last long. I found my way to Morgantown very quickly. I've always had the gift of gab. I've always made friends very quickly. And so I made quick friends with the wrong people. And I got put into what I thought was a really good position at the time, where they sort of put me, let's say, like, high in the ranks of a certain organization, where I was like, I was given a house and a car and a lot of merchandise to, you know, handle certain business for. And I was way over my head, dude. I was 21 or 22 at this time, and I was young, dumb, and really, really hungry, but I didn't know what for, right? It was just anything to get outside of me. Like, anything, right? So I ended up down here.
Running to Baltimore and stuff.
Baltimore was one of them. We did, I don't want to get too into it, but the mail system may or may not have been involved for the majority of our interactions. So commuting wasn't a big thing I had to do. Like I said, I was more in kind of like a management, like middle management position. And that is in no way to say that I was like El Chapo or some sort of decision maker. I was no plug. I wasn't nothing like that, dude. I was young and dumb. That's all it was.
El Chapo. Yeah.
Looking back, I like to play those shoulda, couldas, because I'm like, man, if I knew what I know now, I'd be running this town. And then it's like, shut up, dude. Like, shut up.
I would be El Chapo.
Yeah, that ego is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I took hold of that life, man, because now I got, I got all the money I could really ever want, like, in the moment. I had, power. I had like women. I had like all the boxes were checked for the stuff I thought I wanted, but I still didn't feel whole. I felt more empty and alone than I ever had in my life. And, it didn't matter that I had 10 grand in my pocket that I could throw out the window if I wanted to. Like, I didn't have purpose. I didn't have meaning. I didn't have priorities at all. I had all this money and I didn't have a place that was mine to live. I had all these resources, but I didn't have a car that was mine to drive. I never had more than two pairs of clothes at any given time because I still, even with this house that I have, I still live out of a backpack. I'm still ready to go at any given point, and I did all the time. So it was still very much that derelict kind of lifestyle that, led to me discovering several new drugs of choice, amphetamines came in the picture. There was already a lot of stimulants and psychedelics. I was a big psychonaut. That was a big thing for me. I loved partying and tripping. But then I discovered amphetamines and dissociatives. And that was my, like, dude, like,
ketamine
and meth were the best of times. The worst of times. Like, I lost many a day to those substances, and I was happy to give it up. I still remember the first time I tried meth. I remember the duality in that experience of realizing that I had just given away a piece of my soul, and I was A-okay with it. I was grateful for it. I was like, finally, there it is, right? There's my...
That's that cunning and baffling and the mindset I've talked about on here before. There was a time when there was like some bad ecstasy pills going around and people were dying. And I remember we were popping them. We go, this might be it. Pop it in. Like, the madness of that, dude. Like, who would do that?
My mom died, like I said, secondary to heroin use. And looking back now, this was my moment. I should have known, like, bro, you're an addict. Like, there was no maybe about it. My first thought was like, how good was it that she was willing to give up everything, that everything else went to the side burner to heroin? I'm like, how awesome must it be that you wouldn't care, you wouldn't think about your family or love or any of those things? Like, I was like, man, I gotta try that. And that immediately kind of broke loose, and I was like, yeah, but I don't want to die. But that was my knee jerk, was like, man, that must be good.
Yeah, I was just talking about it last week, because unfortunately I just lost a friend, and just the power of it. I don't think that a lot of people who don't have addiction issues, there's almost no way to explain it. But if it was so easy that you would just like, yeah, I should probably put my family first and go to work, and I should probably care about people who love me. And, it's not like people with addiction issues don't care about their family, or like, I can't put into words, and you guys know how fucking powerful it is, man. Like, there's no reason, there's no magical thing that just makes it not so, that it's just so, I really can't put it into words, but if you've experienced it, that draw is like, it's so fucking powerful, man.
Yeah. It's like, if somebody asked you, like, hey, you like hugs from your mom, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What if you could have a hug from your mom even when your mom's not around? Like that feeling that you get, that like that acceptance, that warmth, that, you know, the reward center dumps that dopamine when dad tells you he's proud of you, when mom gives you a hug, when your best friend, you know, runs up and you're reunited, like boom, dopamine dump. That's what you're getting, you know, without all of the work and all of the, you know, we hate to say that there's strings attached to family, but like, I'm gonna call a spade a spade. Like there's moments that I really cherish, right? When I'm with the people that I love, but then there's the stuff in between, right? Mm-hmm. There's the human experience in both ends that we get to have in that. But what if you could boil it down to just the hug? What if you just had a bag of mom's hugs and you know what I mean? Like,
I get it.
Then you ain't got to hug mama no more because I got a bag of mom hugs. Like,
yeah.
Bag of mom's hugs, dude.
Who the fuck's mom, dude?
Hey, homie, I got the mom hugs on deck. Homie, what's good?
I'm saying. About that,
that brings me to that fucking Gorilla song. What is that, Clint Eastwood, where he talks about having sunshine in a bag?
Yeah, man.
That's it. Yeah. Dude, so I'm always curious with meth users, man. Did you find yourself attracted to random trash and fucking shiny things? Because I remember when I worked up at Progress House, some of our counselors were ex tweakers, and they talked about actually enjoying going and diving in the trash for like shiny things. And they couldn't really explain why they liked it. It's just they felt like they had to have all these treasures. But it sounds like that wasn't a thing for you. You didn't go out on any midnight tweaking sessions.
I have the blessing and the curse of being I have ADHD. Right, I've been diagnosed with ADHD. So meth for me didn't have the same like speedy Gonzalez effect. It really narrowed my whole focus stream very well. And of course there was like, if I used too much, which I always did, there was, it got way past the point of safe return. But for the most part, like my tweaking habits were like writing music. It was like sitting down and just playing guitar for way too fucking long.
So your fingers bleed.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, completely. And that was for me, you know, more or less. And also, this might be a hot take, I don't know, but I would say 90% of my use, even in active addiction, even in the peak when it was like the worst of the worst, was a social event. A lot of my use was social. So there were few and far between. Like I said, 10% of my active use was like the hiding in the bathroom, the, you know, here's what I'll share, here's what I keep, you know. But for the most part, I was sort of raised. I'm gonna kind of personify my use to say that like I was raised into it, right? And I was the way I was raised in that culture was that it was a social thing, you know. The people that I was around, that commune, like it was free love, you know what I mean? It was all of us looking out for each other. So even when we were doing the dirt, we were doing it together. You know, there was no secrets. There was no stigma. There was no shame in that. We were just together doing what we were doing, right?
Yeah.
So, like, a lot, like, we didn't have to go dive in the dumpster because we would put our heads together and, like, come up with wild shit to do. Like, one time we decided, you know, and this is a very, like, meth-fueled experience, but, like, I think we were tripping, too, so that didn't help. But we decided at like 5 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday that our buddy Larry, who had this big giant beard, shout out to Larry. We decided that his beard would look a lot better with a tutu. So at 5 o'clock in the morning, we all pile in my buddy's Jetta and drive into town in Uniontown to go to the dollar store to find him a tutu to put on his beard because he was sleeping. So we wanted him to wake up with a nice tutu on his beard. And so then in our frenzy, we also decide, like, it'd be really cool if we had a spud gun. So, like, we went to Lowe's and we built a spud gun, and then we took it home and I modified it to be able to shoot Whippet cartridges because I had about 3,000 of those little Whippet cartridges spent laying around. And I was like, this has to be, there's got to be something we can do better with these. So I had that, like, that ingenuous kind of, like, we can rebuild this pretty much at everything I looked at, but then I would turn around and either say, we're not going to rebuild it, or this is how we're about to rebuild it. So
I do got to interject here really quick, dude. Now your type of tweaking was not digging in the trash, but finding tutus and going and getting random potato guns sounds like another type of tweaker experience, my man. It was just a different level. I think there's something so funny to how people with ADHD get on those stimulants like Adderall. I've never been formally diagnosed with ADHD. I just know that I have it for a fact. Brian Chandel's been on this podcast before. He's one of our guests. And his sister had an Adderall prescription, and we would take them in the morning. And dude, that shit focused me more than anything on the fucking planet. I had bowling and billiards. I bowled a 260, dude. I was locked in like a laser fucking robot. That's no shit, dude. My PE teacher. Yeah, my PE teacher's like, dude, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. They printed out the sheet for me. I was like, and I'm just sitting there like, yeah, dude, fuck yeah. And then I'd go and smoke weed on the way back from school. Couldn't sleep at night. So it's probably a good thing I didn't smoke meth, dude, because I'd either be figuring out, you know, the theory of general relativity and how we can
be like the president or something.
Yeah, dude. Until they get the Nobel Prize, or I'd be the next bowling champion. Fuck.
I have to imagine too, because of the way our brain works, that there were times when you were like, technically, since I have ADHD, that this meth is like my medicine.
1000%, dude. I justified many a time where I would say like, I want to write some music, because when I lived in that commune, we had like, at one point I was in like three bands that were all gigging at the same time. So like I had to write music, bro. There was no way around it. So I'd be like, all right, we're going to get in the zone. Right. We're going to get a little, and then we're just going to write for the next 48 hours. And like, that's what I would sit down and do. And it wasn't always good. It was more often trash than anything, but I would do it, and I could focus on it, you know? Whereas otherwise, man, Forget about it.
All right. Well, I jumped the gun a little bit earlier, so I'm glad we went back and we got into the story. But what I really want to dig into, because like I said, it's something that I really admire in you. And it's also, I think, my greatest triumph in recovery, which is just being comfortable in my own skin, which, as you alluded to, took a lot of work. And it's, you know, the work isn't done. There's still moments where I'm not, but I've always, I was thinking about this interview, and I think about sometimes, like, I can't imagine Jesse getting mad. I'm sure you do, but I just can't imagine it. Like, you've always got a big smile. You've always got a warm hug. And whenever, you know, some type of problem is presented, you're like, it'll be all right. We'll figure it out, you know? So I kind of wanted to dig into that more, and how you kind of cultivated that, and how you keep it going and keep it positive like that.
Yeah, man. And dude, I really appreciate the kind words, for real. I appreciate that super big. You know, sometimes I wonder if I got a touch of the tism. When it comes to problems, I can't, more often than not, like, I just, my brain can't focus on problems without what now? Like, there's always that question of like, what are we doing about it? Right. Like, I am very solution focused. If we're talking about a problem and we're not talking about the solution, then I'm at a loss, you know? And that's,
your girlfriend loves that, huh?
Yeah, dude. Well, our roles are very flipped, because I am much more, not more, but I am very like, let's talk about our feelings. Let's hash this out. Let's not go to bed with any animosity. Like, you know, I will stay up all night and just hash shit out, because that's what we do. Like, that's what I've been taught to do. And it's not, I wasn't raised that way. I was raised, we don't have feelings, right? We don't, you know, the only ones we show are when we're mad, right? But like, like I said, very solution focused. Anytime I see a problem, anytime I'm experiencing something that's a barrier or a hiccup or what have you, it's just, okay, so what now? Right. And I think that's a lot of that's from like my first sponsor. So, you know, Sutton, shout out to Self Care. That's my boy. He was my first sponsor ever, man. And
wow,
dude. And what I loved was that he was only a few months ahead of me in recovery. Right.
Yeah.
And Ryan's the same way. Ryan Fieldman's my new sponsor, and he's like a year or less, you know, ahead of me in time or whatever you want to call it. But we were very much on that same level, right? There wasn't this like, oh my God, this guy's got 30 years of recovery. Like, oh, he's you know, up on this pedestal. It was just like, okay, this is a bro that's working steps, and he can show me how to do that too. So I bought into that trial membership, man, where people, you know, they made the suggestions about like, show up early, stay late, you know, get a service position, get a sponsor, call your sponsor. Like, I tried those things. I like to really preface to say, like, I'm not, by no means am I perfect. I don't adhere perfectly to suggestions or rules, but I was trying it on for size. So I figured if I wanted to come back and tell you guys how stupid you were and how wrong you were about this wonderful program, that I had to try it to the best of my ability to be able to come back and school you on how stupid you were, right? So I did that. I did all those things, and I blew Sutton up every day, all day. I would call him before I tried a different cereal, before I responded to something that I was emotionally, you know, involved with. I called him for everything, man. And like you said, I had a lot of those tribulations going on at that time in early recovery. I had multiple pending court cases in different states where I didn't think, I knew I was going to prison, bro. There was no maybe in my mind. There was no hope for anything else, right? So I would call him for all those things. Like, hey, man, I got another hearing coming up tomorrow. I was in court like a few times a month for the first couple of years, you know? And so I would call him constantly and just be like, what do I do? How do I get through this? What, you know, be my hands, man. Like, please just help me. And he would just continue to like take me back to the moment. Like, what can you control? You know, where are your feet? What power do you have? Are you exercising the freedom that you have in order to best position yourself for the best possible outcome? And he would always turn it back to me. So like, okay, there's your problem. What are you doing about it? He would always take it back to that. Like, so what now? You know? And I think that really locked in, man, because, you know, there's a line in the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous that says, you know, we're not responsible for our disease, but we are responsible for our recovery. And I really took that to heart when I read it, because it was like at that moment, all of those excuses were no longer valid. You know, I couldn't blame mom. I couldn't blame the justice system. I couldn't blame anybody, because it was my feet that I was responsible for moving. And it was my hands that I used to do whatever I did. So, you know, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It matters who's responsible, you know? So I'm not going to say like the light switch flipped and I just started being super responsible. Like, no. But I showed up, you know, and that was the big thing. You know, looking my problems in the face and figuring out that solution, or just accepting that I'm powerless if I am, you know, that was a really big struggle piece for me. Because when we talk about surrender and powerlessness and acceptance, like those sound so mighty. Those sound so like Gandhi type stuff, right? Acceptance to me is still a big order, right? I can tolerate, but it's really hard to accept, you know? I can shut my mouth, but I can't always like say the most loving thing. You know, I don't always have loving things to say. So sometimes I just shut my mouth, right? Like, that's, you know, a lot of the, you know, I had a sponsee one time I was trying to get him to share at a meeting. I always told my sponsees, like, you know, the first few times I see you in a meeting, I want to hear you share. And usually I would suggest just saying something like, hey, I'm new, you know, just trying this thing on, or just like speak from the heart, you know, something short and sweet. And this guy kept bucking, you know, every meeting he'd be like, oh, next one. Or, you know, he would come up with a reason why he didn't share. And one day I pulled him outside, you know, after the meeting, and I was like, what's up, man? Are you okay? Like, are you just nervous? Or, you know, what are you thinking? What's going on? And he's like, man, I have social anxiety. And, you know, he's like, I just kind of like tense up and I freak out when I'm about to share. And I'm like, I'm going to tell you something that I don't tell a lot of people, but like, I'm anxious a lot of the time, a lot of the time. And the only trick that I know to get through it is to fucking go through it. And like, and it sounds real like pull yourself up by the bootstraps, but like, just fucking do it, you know? Like, it's not, like I said earlier, you guys can't hurt me. Your words can't hurt me. Like, there's nothing like physically that's going to come to harm me because I open my mouth, right? Or because I speak directly or ask a tough question, you know? So like, I live, and I really appreciate you being like, oh, I can't even picture you getting mad. Like, bro, the only reason I can be calm is it's like the Hulk, you know, it's like, I'm always mad, right? Like, but it's more anxiety. It's like, I'm always fucking anxious. And I live with it, right? I cope with it. Sometimes it's a lot easier to manage. And sometimes like lately, dude, for the past month, I've been a lightweight nervous wreck, you know, 90% of the time. And it's been really tough to deal with. You know, I've been leaning towards getting back in with a psychiatrist to get some medication for it, because I am like my typical coping skills that have been successful for the past 7 years, which it's 7 years, by the way, Hen, they're just not cutting it. You know, I'm more or less just like biding my time, but being aware of the fact that like that is something that exists, and feelings are not exclusive, right? Like I can be anxious and excited at the same time. Sometimes they're kind of commingled, right? I can be mourning and grief and grieving and celebrating new life at the same time. Like those can exist in the same space. And until I realize that like feelings aren't facts, feelings don't fucking call the shots. Like my hands, I do what I want with these things. Then like, it doesn't matter how I feel, you know? And if I say like, oh, I'd go, but I'm anxious. Well, guess what? That's not a fucking reason now. That's an excuse. You know, I'm a little anxious and I'm going. So like, hey, Hen, just so you know, man, like if you see me standing off to the side a little bit, like that's why, just a heads up. Like I'm coming, I'll be at the convention, but like I might be, you know, I'm a little off. Like that's going in spite of, right? And that's healthy fear. That's healthy coping. But like any feeling that stops me from doing something that is good for me or brings happiness and health to my life is bullshit. And I have no room for it, man.
Dude, there's a lot to unpack there. But first and foremost, I just want to say I stand with you in solidarity on the anxiety struggle. So I think what you're doing is very healthy. And I personally appreciate you being transparent about it. Like, hey, I'm scared, but I'm going to go anyway. Right. And that's the right behavior. Right. Because that's how we train our brain that this convention isn't a danger, because that's all the anxiety is doing. It's your amygdala firing off. We've had a whole episode about it. And me and you can maybe reconnect. I have a few resources that helped me get through, you know, some really bad anxiety, loops aside from medication. I'm on medication and I'm pro medication for it because my shit is bad. But anyways, when it comes to resolving shit, I think that it's one of the greatest blessings that I've gotten from the program. And it's also one of the greatest curses, because I instantly want to fix things, like you said, right? Like, hey, there's an issue in the room. Let me come in here, find the fucking problem. Let's talk about it, resolve it, and be done with it, right? Because I'm on this one day at a time deal. Everything's fine. Hey, we're good. We talked about it. Everything's tits. Well, in some cases, finding that leeway or that middle ground where, hey, sometimes people don't want to resolve it right away, Cameron, and maybe they just want to fucking maybe they just want to tell you their feelings. How about you just sit there and listen? My wife has to tell me that on occasions when she tells me her problems. Be like, hey, I don't need a solution. I just need you to listen. And for me, that's been one of my hardest struggles, right? Because we want to fix it, right? Because we've done this self-discovery. Like, hey, how do I fix it? I take it on the chin at face value. I find the solution and I fix it. And then I move forward. But everybody who's not an addict, they might not be operating that way. And for me, it can get a little frustrating and I can cop resentments. And I don't really know where I'm going with that. But I think it's a very interesting dichotomy, man, that like I'm trying to help, right? I've said it on this podcast, like, let me fucking help you. I have the solution. But sometimes that's not what they want. And we have to sit back and do what you said. Pause when agitated, shut our fucking mouth, and let it happen when it happens.
One thing that we've talked about on here before, and I think this is kind of goes along with basically what Jesse was talking about and what you were just alluding to, as addicts, when we've been through so much, we've been through real hard times, we've put ourselves in really shitty positions, and we've come out the other end. And I love your little nugget. We always get a great nugget from our guests. And I think the "you can't hurt me" is a great fucking nugget. It's like anti-anxiety medicine in a phrase. You can't hurt me. Like we've survived all our worst days so far. But back to what I was talking about, like we've been through so much shit that it's like, oh, your coworker ate your granola bar? Like
that's so true.
I think you'll be all right. Like I was facing prison time for six felonies. Like I'll buy you a new granola bar.
Bro, I've been dead. What are you bitching about? Like, dog, my heart stopped beating. Like, what are you
That's it.
Not that serious.
Exactly.
You're making me think about like when my girl comes home from work and she immediately just goes to vent about her day. And I know now, like, that's all she's doing. She's just venting about her day. And she'll tell me like, oh, this coworker, blah, 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 this, that. And, you know, solution, right? So I had to start asking her, Cam, I'm so glad you brought that up, bro. Because I have to ask her, like, are you just venting or do you need a solution? Yeah, right? Man. Because my solution is quit your job, you know? Quit your job, send an email. You know, I'm like, here's the list, right? Here's the things we can do to mitigate the risk. You know, you have this much potential in the quality of your life and you're currently experiencing this. So how can we get you from this to this? Right. There's a clear path that we can illuminate with clear steps, with real timelines. But is that what you're looking for? Probably not. Like sometimes
your email will begin, fuck your entire bloodline.
Yeah. Sometimes you just want to get that steam out, man. I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah.
People don't always want or need the solution. Sometimes they just want have someone listen to what they have going on. And yeah, man, I really do love that. You can't hurt me. And I love how you brought up, because I describe what I have. I also have anxiety, but I think you put it into perfect perspective. I would call what I have high functioning anxiety. Like, I'm fucking worried about it. I don't like it, but I'm going to go and it's going to be all right. I think I have a good ability to talk myself off the ledge. No one's going to come after you. No one's. My favorite example is I go in, like being in construction, especially, I go into the gas station a lot to use the bathroom. And almost every fucking time, it's gotten better now, but I go, I wish this motherfucker would say, hey, you got to be a customer. You got to buy something. I'll tell him, you know how much fucking gas I bought at this gas station? I'll buy a fucking candy bar. And then I'm like, Henry, when's the last time somebody fucking said something, bro? Never. Maybe once ever. But I'm ready to fight this cashier who's hypothetically going to be pissed. And dude, they work for fucking minimum wage. They give a fuck less if you use their bathroom. Yeah. No one ever says anything. Yep. And I have, bro, no one cares if you use the bathroom, dude. Just chill. Like, it's all good. But I have to like talk myself down from these ledges. And I do these things like I just push through it, you know, because it's, am I worried about it? Yeah. But like, is it going to be okay? Yeah. So we'll just do it, you know?
Dude, there's these levels to anxiety, right? Like that's like, you know, common everyday anxiety, shit like that. And then there's disordered anxiety where you're afraid of being afraid, right? Like you're actually afraid of your own, like, natural body's reaction, like the uncomfortability. Like I can relate to a month of tension, right? Where like, do you suffer from panic attacks, Jesse? Do you get panic attacks and shit like that?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not often, but when I do.
Yeah, they come, man. And those can be fucking terrifying, dude, if you don't know what that is on the physiological level. Like,
yeah, because your brain doesn't know the difference between it and dying.
No, it doesn't.
There's no idea.
It does.
There's a difference in that you're not actually dying because it's like, the ship's going down.
Yeah.
This is it. Send off the life rafts. Like,
it's the monkey. Dude. It's the monkey that's sitting there banging the cymbals, bro. And the funny thing is like what you're actually panicking about is just like a 21st century problem, right? Like that mechanism is for fucking, you know, a tiger jumping out of the bushes to eat you. And that part of the brain has never learned to change. So, ooh, my mortgage payment's going to be late. Boom, boom, boom. Panic attack. Bam, 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 bam. Adrenaline floods. Boom. Tingling fingers, the whole deal, bro. Tight
dude,
chest.
How much leftover energy at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's an adrenaline. It's an adrenaline rush, dude. It's an ill-timed adrenaline rush, and it feels fucking terrible. And the funny thing is that even with myself knowing that, it still doesn't make those fucking panic attacks any easier to deal with. It still hurts, and it's still, I'll wake up and I'll be, ooh, one day I'll wake up and there's that cortisol rush first thing in the morning. And if I don't handle that properly, I'm in for a rough fucking day. I'm in for a rough day if I don't get myself in line first thing in the morning. And I'm not going to go into a big anxiety fucking talk, but I love talking with fellow anxiety sufferers, dude, because it's a battle, bro. It's a fucking battle, dude. And especially it's a battle sober, right? Because I've mentioned it on here, like, dude, I drank every minute of every day, so I didn't have to feel that way. Yep. And when I got rid of the booze, like, how do I fucking deal with this?
When you're Ricky Bobby, like, what do I do with my hands?
out here raw dogging life, dude.
Dude, I'll be completely transparent, man. In 2021, I had the worst anxiety spell of my life, dude, where I literally had, I would pace my backyard, and I finally looked over to my wife, and my wife's standing there with Addison, and Addison's asking, what's wrong with daddy? Because I couldn't get myself out of the anxiety loop. I was having panic attacks 24/7, intrusive thoughts about killing everybody and God knows what else. And, you know, it was a bad fucking time, dude. And luckily I found some tools to get myself out of it. But man, it's a dark fucking place when you get into that disordered anxiety place, man. It's no fucking joke.
Word. Well, I'm glad you made it through that, brother.
Thanks, dude. Thanks. Sure. I pretend I do, at least, dude.
Well, you're still here. You know, there's a lot of us that don't, like, yeah. Like Henry said, like the first, or maybe it was you, like the first time you have that panic attack, you know.
Oh, dude,
You think you're dying, right? You feel like you're dying, and you know, not everybody makes it through, man. So that's a big deal.
It's true.
For real, because that is, like I said, that's that, like, life-altering, possibly life-ending moment that, you know, you're like, you know, your wits are not about you, right? You are way, I know me, like... Over the past couple months, especially the last 30 days, I've really had to be mindful of making decisions, because I've had a lot of those fuck it moments where I'm just like, you know what? Maybe I'll just do the homesteading thing. Maybe I'll sell my house. Maybe I'll just get away from people, right? Like, I have these like major fuck it thoughts, these ideas of grandeur where I'm like, yeah, no, I could just leave everything behind. I'll quit my job, pull the kids out of school. We'll just go live in the woods. Right?
Just need a fucking axe and like.
Yeah, because I don't like the way I feel. I'm going to disrupt my entire family's lives. Like, that's the way to do it, right? Probably not. Might hold off on that for a day or two and see how we feel then.
Yeah.
But it seems like I can't make crazy big decisions in those moments. And funny enough, I actually just did make one of those crazy big decisions. And it was a career change, or rather a career change back. And it was really, really hard, because I'm in the midst of, you know, just constant, like, daily anxiety. And there's external and intrinsic, you know, motivation for that. So I'm really having to, like, use my support group to determine, like, is this because of the chemical imbalance I'm experiencing? Or do the boxes that I'm checking actually deserve to be checked, right? I'm looking at kind of like my career position and where I was at and how it was affecting my life. You know, and how it was affecting my ability to be present with my family. And on paper, right, that all looks like, okay, this is a negative, you know, return on my investment, basically. But I'm also feeling real sideways internally. So I'm like, I need to separate my experience from what I think is happening. And I had to bounce that off of a lot of people, which was absolutely nerve-wracking, dude, completely. Because I just left, like, at 25, I would have killed a man for the job that I just left. But now it's a million times more important to me to not only be home with my family, but to be present with my family when I'm home, you know? And like I said, I just left this opportunity that, you know, a younger Jesse and that part of me that's still alive was over the moon about, you know, just endless opportunity financially and service-wise to be able to, like, make a bunch of money and help so many people. But I had to boil it down, you know, and ask, like, what am I taking home with me? Like, how is my day to day? What do I have to bring to the table here if I continue this grind? Right. And so that was something that I had to come to. And it was really hard, dude, because I was just feeling like a whole bag of dicks the entire time. And, you know, I'm talking this, like, you know, this will increase my quality of life if I make this jump. And the truth is, I don't know, right? I don't know if it's going to increase the quality of my life. All I have is the cause and effect, right? I left the job I had, moved to this other company, started, you know, majorly dropping in my mood and overall disposition. And so the only thing I could think is, like, I need to get out of this position to see if it affects my life positively. And lo and behold, I feel like a way smaller bag of dicks today. You know, and I just made the jump. I just started back at my old company on Monday, you know, and I'm already feeling a lot lighter, you know.
That's huge, dude. And I congratulate you on making that jump, because it's scary. And that's such a huge microcosm of what is important to me. Is all the monies in the world important to me, or is being at home with my family? You know, I recently went through a change in my job. And just to be quick about it, like, I was just fucking unhappy, dude. I was very unhappy and I had to bust a move. And that's one thing, you know, I've always shared about meetings. I shared about with sponsees and anybody who will listen. Like, if you're the only person, like you talked about, who's in control of your destiny, you're the only person who gets to make decisions about what the fuck you do. So if you're unhappy, bust a fucking move. And that's what you did. And it's hard and it's scary. And sometimes it seems counterintuitive, but the fact that you did it because you listened to, you know, your insides and what the fuck was going on is huge, dude. And I love that. So we've derailed on anxiety, which is awesome because a lot of people suffer from it. So if you haven't listened to the anxiety episode, go back and listen to it. And also we will link some of Cameron's resources in here since we talked about it a lot. If that's something you suffer with, check it out.
For sure.
But I'm going to get back to some other stuff I wanted to talk about. So one of the things that you and I share, and actually Cameron, is our love of music. And one of the things that you and I do together often, not as often as we'd like, but often, is going to concerts and stuff. And I think there's, you know, there's the big stigma of, I'll never have fun. I can't, what am I going to do? And so you're an avid concert goer. So how did that go, maybe like in the beginning, and how do you go through that sober, and what's your experience of sober concerts?
Yeah, dude. Awesome question. And, this is something I tread lightly on when I'm in like 12 step meetings because it ruffles a lot of feathers. But, I make it no secret, dude. Like, live music is a huge part of my life. It's a huge part of my journey. And I really had a hard time believing what people were trying to convince me of, which was, you know, that I only went to concerts so that I could be around the culture, you know? And I think that it was kind of the other way around, in that I was so engulfed in, and I would do anything to be around live music. Therefore, I accepted the culture that came with it. And I really engulfed myself in that because that allowed me to continue the cycle, right? If I'm on tour, if I'm selling drugs or whatever, that's a good reason to go to the next show, right? But getting into recovery, you know, Henry, you know, Benjamin, Cam, you haven't had the pleasure. You might need a 5-hour podcast if you ever want to have him on. He talks more than me and I'd be talking. So I meet this guy, right? I'm in treatment and, you know, they brought a 12-step recovery meeting into the facility that I was at. And there was a few of our friends that Henry, that we have now today, that I met then, even before I would consider myself in recovery. That was still my trial basis. But they came in and they gave us these meetings, and Benjamin came in, and he's an old hippie, old deadhead. And mm-hmm. he had this dog named Althea that he would bring with him, that he would let me pet her, and we would talk about music. And until I met him, I had about a month or so in treatment before, you know, where I was developing this concept of what recovery would look like. And I still had the image of, like you said, like sitting on my hands and just waiting to die, but like being, right. but I could be proud because I died sober. Right. And I was like, that can't be it. And I'm like, please tell me that's not it. And that sounded lame as fuck. So I was like, if that's all I have to look forward to in recovery, like, I'm probably going to go smoke some crack, you know, like, I know what to expect from that. And so, I got in, you know, I got in the rooms and I had a lot of legal stuff. So, travel wasn't, possible for a while. And also I really wanted to give this thing the old college try. I didn't want to just dive back into the old ways and, you know, places and playthings. So I gave it some time, and I think it was about a year. I was right around a year when the first show I ever went to was with Ryan Fieldman and Jack. And nice. And we went to go see Lotus in Pittsburgh for a New Year's show. And we were going to have – so I was at a meeting. It was a Saturday night, and we had a New Year's Eve NA dance that night that I was planning on going to. And I was going to look pretty fresh, if I might say so. I was going to find me a nice girl with tattoos and, you know, track marks and low self-esteem. And and so a nice girl, though, you know, a nice girl to hurt my feelings. And so I'm at this meeting, and I think Ryan was there, Ryan or Jack, one of them. But they were like, oh, hey, you know, I know you're a music junkie. Why don't you, are you coming to Lotus tonight? And I was like, bro, I wish, blah, 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 you know, sober house.
But I'm in recovery and I'm not allowed to have fun no more and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know, I'm going to the dance and blah, blah, blah. And they were like, dude, you should really think about coming to the show. And I was like, all right, whatever. So I called my sponsor, which was Ryan's roommate at the time. And I was like, hey, Ryan wants to know if I can go to, you know, if I want to go to the show with him. And I do, but like, can you tell me that I actually want to or not or what? And he was like, you know, if you're with people in recovery, man, go have a good time. See how the shoe fits. And he's like, you'll be safe, you know, you'll be in a safe place with good people and whatever. So I went and it was a little nerve wracking. I'll be honest, because for me, my preferred live music experience is festivals. I love camping festivals. I'm a marathon, not a sprint guy, as you can tell by my drugs of choice. I don't like short bursts of experiences. I want the whole thing, right? So like 3-4 days camped out in a field where the music doesn't stop. That's my, you know, picture perfect experience. So I go to this show, and the minute we walk into the venue, these two beautiful little hippie ladies come up to me, and they must have smelled it on me. I don't know what it was, but they were like, hey, you got any acid? And I was frozen, dude. I was dead in my tracks. Like, I wanted to say yes for whatever reason. And I just didn't know what to say, right? So I was like, And luckily, Ryan was right behind me. So he, like, came over my shoulder and was like, not tonight. And just kind of pulled me away. And I was like, those are magic words, dude. How'd you do that? So I kept that in my pocket. Not tonight. I don't say no. Well, now I say no. But early on, I didn't say no because that, you know, that could cause a follow-up question. But if it's not tonight, I'm just drawing my line for tonight. Like, just for tonight, I'm not using. And we went to the show, and I had a pretty good time. I still didn't really kind of know what to do with my hands most of the time, but it was a good time. And then I went to a festival. And then it was probably 6 months later. I bought tickets to a festival, and I tried my darndest to find anybody in recovery that would go with me to this festival, and nobody would. Everyone was scared to death. And I'm like, man, I get it. Like, I understand apprehension, but I'm trying to like enjoy my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And I want to surround myself with people that also do that. So I do not recommend this to people in early recovery because it was dicey the way I did it. But I went by myself, and I went with the sheer kind of like ripcord in place that if I get to feeling like I want to use or like I'm gonna use, I'm out. Like, I'm just gonna leave. So I went and I made a big show to everyone that I met. Like, before I even told them my name, I told them I was in recovery. I put it way out there on Front Street for everyone, including and especially my friends that were there who were still using. And, you know, they were just a little more responsible a little bit than me. So, you know, I go to the show and I started feeling a little weird, and I told my friends who were very supportive when they were sober, but when they started getting inebriated, that support kind of dwindled. And then they're like, oh, smell this, and oh, you don't want a drink of this, you pussy. And I'm like, okay. So I'm like gearing up to leave. I'm like, all right, this ain't it. I'm about to head out. And I was like, it's a long drive home. I'm going to take a walk around the venue first, maybe say my goodbyes, just kind of feel it out, right? So I take a walk, and it's a big giant loop around this farm that we're at, and as I'm walking, I'm thinking about the second step, and I'm thinking about what I'm supposed to do to get outside of myself, which is where I was. So I just, everybody that didn't look completely blacked out, I would just walk up to them, introduce myself, and tell them like, hey, I'm a person in early recovery, and I'm not sure how to do this way. And the love and support that I got from complete strangers, people that were still using, was it nothing short of a miracle, man. It was, I would say 99% of the people that I talked to, there was only one person that I remember standing out who was like, hey bro, we're doing a lot of nefarious things over here, so I hope you have a great time, but this probably isn't the place, you know, to do it here at the campsite. And I was like, cool, man. No worries. I respect it. Thanks for the heads up. And I kept going. I finally get back to the stage. And the last person that I did my, you know, Hail Mary to was this lady, and her name's Dawn. And I'll never forget her as long as I live, because I ran into her and I did the same thing. Hey, you know, person in early recovery, I'm struggling. And it turns out she was an ADC. She was an addictions and drug counselor. and we sat down in front of the stage, and she just let me vent to her for forever, you know, for probably an hour. And by the time we were done, by the time I was done, she didn't do a lot of talking. by the time I was done, she thanked me for sharing my experience. And then she told me that she was a therapist. And, you know, we just had a really, really good experience. And I wouldn't consider her like a forever friend. We don't keep in touch like that, but we do still go to festivals, you know, the same festivals. So I'll see her. I've seen her a couple times, and I've made sure to thank her every time, because if it wasn't for her, if it wasn't for, I don't know if I would have found another Dawn, you know, but that interaction and all the subsequent interactions that I had up until that point really solidified the love that I have for the culture that surrounds the music scene. So it's not just the scene. It's not just the music. It's the people that go, you know, it's that, and this is a festival thing too. It's that I'm checking out from all of the social constructs that exist in the 9-to-5 world, in the capitalist society that we exist in, that I very much indulge in on a regular basis. But when we're in that mode, you know, that vacation mode, that have a good time mode, we get to be something really, really special, you know? And a lot of people like to put on, I feel like I'm acting more in my day job and more in my daily life than I am when I'm there, because I'm a weird dude. Like, I'd be weird, right?
Embrace the weird.
Totally, bro. I let that flag fly. And so those are the places I get to go to not only listen to great music and like have a spiritual experience, but I get to meet and just be around people that are there for nothing but, for the most part, having a good time, being a good time, you know? And I love that, man. So I do encourage people in recovery to just find what makes them feel that. Like, I call a lot of music experiences that I've had, especially recently, I call them church, because, you know, I've cultivated my music taste to know that if I'm going to a show, I'm going to be looking for a certain type of experience, a certain connection, you know, with either the people around me, the world, you know, that we're in, or what have you. And I think it's paramount. It's non-negotiable that people who want to live happy and healthy and full lives, we have to have at least one thing that gives us that connection feeling, that feeling that we get when we're in the big hug at the end of the meeting or at the end of the convention, where everybody's saying the serenity prayer and you feel that atmosphere of recovery, that spirit of recovery. That's what I feel when I'm in a crowd of people while somebody is melting my face with a guitar solo or hitting a high note that makes no sense coming out of their body. Those are like, that's church for me, man. And for some people, you know, that's them climbing a rock face, or that's them, you know, designing a menu for their restaurant, or, you know, that's them hitting a new PR at the gym. Like, I over encourage to not only like do the things you think you like, but try the things that you never liked in the past. You know, I never liked tomatoes until I got clean, bro. I love tomatoes now. I wouldn't fucking touch them with the 10-foot pole. You know, we need those things, man. I need those things.
Yeah, don't you say I didn't get sober to be fucking bored or whatever? Isn't that?
Yeah, I didn't get clean to be lame as fuck, dude. Yeah. Like, and that's what
I've heard said a bunch by you and other people, and it's so true, man. And I say the same thing. Like, life doesn't end when you get clean; it actually gets a lot better. And I think one of the keys to that is something we talked about before with concerts. Like, I used to drink because I was anxious and so I could loosen up, right? Well, once I started being comfortable being myself, I'm having more fun than the people who are drunk or as much. Like, I'm feel comfortable being myself, so I'll get weird and do whatever, because why? You can't hurt me. What are you gonna do? What's this stranger at the concert going to do? What?
Oh, you're going to give me a weird look? Ah! I'm like, get the fuck out of here, bro.
Yeah.
I'm vibing.
I'm at church.
Word. Dude, I was at a show with Ryan Fieldman. It was one of the first times I ever went back to music. And we were at a show. It was in Morgantown at 123. And there was this guy. There was this dude that was clearly rolling. Like, he was off his rocker. But he was dancing his entire soul out. the whole time, front stage, front, you know, front and center, right in front of the stage, didn't move from that spot, but he was moving. He was getting it, dude. Set break comes along. We go outside to have a cigarette, and I'm like, I need some moves, man. I got nothing but white boy moves in the arsenal, and I don't have a whole lot of rhythm in here. I was just kind of doing the emo shuffle, you know? So I walked up to him, and I was like, hey, man, you think you could teach me a couple dance moves? And he was like, oh, yeah. And he goes, just move your shoulders, move your hips, move your feet, and find the beat. And I must have, and dude, I know I looked like an entire fool for the next like half an hour. But then I found my beat, or like I found my groove, man. And I'm sure I still look goofy when I'm dancing, but like, I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm having so much fun, bro. Just, it's not about you,
the other people.
Me.
Yeah.
This is my church.
And my only thing that I would put in for the listeners, if you do want to go to shows or sporting events or stuff like that, definitely do it the way Jesse did the first show, which is bring, as long as you have like two solid people in that are in recovery as well, you're good. You guys will watch out for each other and you'll be good.
Yeah.
All right, man, we gotta get to wrapping it up a little bit. So I must ask you, what is your favorite part about recovery?
Oh, I'm going to get real cheesy with you, bro.
Nice.
I got to do it. It's freedom, dude. It's the fact that Joey Ferguson always said it. How free do you want to be?
Mm.
You know, and I like to think I want to be pretty free. So to me, what that means is that I get to do whatever I want to do. There's no limits, right? And I get to accept the consequences for whatever I decide to do. So the freedom that I have today to really just be the man that I want to be, right? Which is not always this perfect spiritual, I can't levitate, I can't do any of that crazy shit, like, but I'm happy, you know, I'm very content. That's it for me, man. You know,
nice.
It's being a free man. It's the fact that with 3 years clean, I got arrested for a 4-year-old undercover buy that an officer did on me. And with 3 years clean, I had to do a weekend in jail. And luckily, my boss bonded me out, but I still had to do that time in jail on an extradition warrant that they don't typically give bonds for. So for all I knew, I was down for the count with 3 years clean. And I have never felt so free in a jail cell in my entire life. I laid up in there because I knew that I had done everything I needed to do to promote a positive outcome in my life. So I knew that I left no stone unturned and that I had those gifts that regardless of, you know, you take the stuff out of my pockets, you can take my pockets, but you can't hurt me.
Yeah. I love it. That's what they're. All right. And then I'll ask our last one here. What would you say to somebody who is struggling right now, Jesse?
I'm going to fall in line with the bootstrap thing a little bit, because once I learned that I was the one that was responsible for the life that I get to live, there's no more fucking excuses, man. And I try to frame this in a way that is loving, because I know how hard it was for me to get to that point where I was even willing to try and form the sentence to ask for help. And I didn't know the words, and I didn't know who to ask. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what the fuck to do. I just knew something had to change. And so there's no excuse. If somebody's listening to this podcast, if somebody is touched by, you know, a message of hope or recovery, then there's no more excuses to ever feel alone. Ever again.
Amen to that.
Because rude dudes here, because, you know, in West Virginia, we have Help for West Virginia. You know, I'm an advocate. I live and I work with dozens of other advocates that we're doing our very best to get the word out there to let people know you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it doesn't always require, you know, getting locked down and locked up. And, you know, I have the blessing, man, that I get to work with people who, you know, are not always like me in their external circumstances. When I got clean, it was because I had nothing left. I get to help people before they lose everything. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I get to help people who have the same feelings that I did when I, you know, was ready to get clean. But the difference was I was homeless. I was broke. I had, you know, charges out the wazoo. And I'm talking to people that live in multi-million dollar homes that still have sustainable income and families that love them and support them. And they feel the same exact way. So I get to deliver that message of hope to let them know, like, you're going to get through this. Mm-hmm. And you can get through this. And you're not alone. There's no good reason to feel that way. Even though the reason that we live with is, you know, it's not a super good one to begin with. Mm-hmm. But there is a major message of hope that we're trying to ring through the hills, especially here in Appalachia, where people are dropping like flies, man.
Hell yeah, bro.
So where would people go to, and we can put a link in the description or whatever, but how would people reach out if they're looking for help?
Dude, there's a bunch of options. Some of the best ones are SAMHSA. SAMHSA has a treatment finder. So SAMHSA, I believe it's .gov. You guys can post a link to confirm, but they have a treatment finder on there. So if somebody's looking for, if somebody's looking for any level of care, inpatient, outpatient, you know, just a support group, something like that, you can go to the treatment finder on SAMHSA's website, and it's like a little search engine. You can plug everything in like Google. It's actually even a little better. You can plug in where you're at, male, female, veteran, what type of insurance, how far you're willing to go. You know, you can really plug all that information in. That's an amazing resource to utilize. And that's typically my go-to if I'm just kind of like, you know, here's a pamphlet, keep moving. I'm always available as well. I work day or night. I take calls typically more often at night, but I take calls all day long from people that are looking for help for them, for their families. You know, our network of treatment centers is nationwide. We're all over the country. And I have partners that I work with literally in all 50 states. So I'm not the only one with access to resources like this, and I'm damn sure not the keeper of the gate. So if somebody wants to know, like, specifically, hey, I'm in Indiana and, you know, I could really use some help for somebody I love, you know, I'm always available for that. So feel free to drop my info as well.
My man.
Hell yeah, man. Well, hey, dude, you've been a fantastic guest, man.
Thanks,
man. You got a really good head on your shoulders, bro. And Henry is correct, man. You have an infectious attitude. It's good to see people like that in our community, man. And I'm glad that you were able to, you know, go out to those music festivals. And it's crazy. I call those little moments then when you found whatever that lady's name was, Dawn, was it? Mm-hmm. I call those moments God moments, man. So I'm glad that, you know, things like that just fall into place sometimes. And it just really reiterates that you're on the right path. So I personally just want to say thank you for coming on, man. And it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'll get your information. I'll send you some anxiety stuff too, man. So just keep fighting the good fight, brother.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Jesse. I appreciate you too, man. I appreciate your time. And it's funny when you said that, I take my calls at night. I'm like, cool. We just probably kept like three addicts from getting to treatment by taking an hour and a half of your time.
No, I've been emailing the whole time. They're like going ADHD over here. Life. Life.
I got you, player. Give me 15. I'm going to get you right in there, dog.
I'm working on my three referrals right now.
My man.
Yeah.
Saving lives while he's talking about saving lives on a podcast about saving lives, brother.
About saving his own life, dude. I mean, what the fuck? What's going on, dude?
Oh yeah,
shit, I need help too, man. Don't count me out.
All right, bro. Well, hey, we might have to have you back on, dude, because I think there's more that you have to say. So
what's the next get down, Jesse? Dude, we got to go to the orchestral performance of The Chronic.
I'm already on it, bro. Next Saturday they're doing an orchestra performance of Dr. Dre, and me and my lady will be up there in Pitt. We're gonna go get a nice dinner and go get down.
That sounds fire.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah, but Reggae Rise Up, baby. Baltimore. Don't sleep on it. Right. Cam, they got one coming out your way, too. They're doing one on the West Coast here soon as well.
All right,
so.
Dude. All right.
Let's get it.
All right, dude. Well, hey, we'll let you go, man. Love Thanks you, again. Have a good night, brother.
Appreciate y'all.
Later. My man.
Dude, that's a cool dude, man. That's a cool dude. Very intelligent, you can tell. He has a way of saying things that really gets the point across. So he was a really good guest, man. I enjoyed it. He was one of those that I could kind of sit back and just listen to without having to really jump in. I got a little excited about the anxiety thing because, like, oh, hey, you're fucked up like me. Hey, let's talk about it. You know about
you're
amygdalas?
Just like me, trash.
Yeah, you got panic attacks, buddy? Here, let's talk about it. But yeah, dude, he was great, dude. I enjoyed that a lot, man. I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, I got to say something, too. What was interesting, I was thinking about, you and our listeners didn't really get to see the Jesse that I know as much. I mean, not that he was someone different. Let me explain. He's a fun-loving, happy, fun, joking, fuck-around guy. But we got him in this instant. He's so passionate about recovery and how he got where he got and how he can help other people that he was like in that mode. So like this happy, fun guy that I normally interact with is not so much who he was. And that's not a bad thing at all. I think what he gave us was awesome because he was giving us the recipe of how he got where he's at. It was really cool to see because like I said, when I thought about it, I was like, oh, he's fired up to like spread this message. And that's dope too.
Yeah, dude, he showed up. He showed up on a mish.
Oh, yeah. Dude, there were some awesome nuggets in there. The one I didn't get to touch back on was tolerate, not accept. Mm. We practice acceptance a lot. And like he said, that's a bitch, dude. I don't want to accept some of this stuff. But what a little treat to give yourself or give a sponsee or give someone, hey, man, you might not accept it, but if you could just at least fucking tolerate it, because either way, you're not going to change it. But just, you know, tolerate it. If you think you can't accept it, just tolerate it. Just a little nugget to help you get by. And then the other one, man, is you can't hurt me. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, when you imagine these people, whatever this scenario you've made up in your head, that it's gonna, you can't hurt me, man. Yeah. You know what I've been through? I was looking at prison time. Like, you can't hurt me. Mm-hmm. What are you going to make? Like you said, make funny faces at me and tell your friends I'm weird. Who fucking cares? You know?
Yeah, dude. And that's that sense of fucking freedom that I hope everybody can, you know, really kind of manifest, you know, like, hey, you can't hurt me, dude. I don't give a fuck what you think about me. And, mm-hmm. and I'm not afraid of your opinion of me either. Right. And that's a next level of freedom, shall I say.
Absolutely.
And I think he was a great guest, dude. And I love that he's literally sitting here talking to us about the solution and all the variations of it. And he's sitting there sending emails trying to get people into treatment, which is gonna lead me perfectly into my Creewins quote of the week. And the Creewins quote of the week is by a different saint, bro, Saint Francis of Assisi. But this one is perfect for Jesse. You ready?
Okay.
Blessed is the servant who loves his brother as much when he is sick and useless as when he is well and can be of service of him.
Shoo.
Dude.
Blessed Jesse.
Yep, that's him, dude. He's taking care of the sick, fucking, you know, loving them no matter what. So I think that's fantastic, dude. I think it's super cool, man. What do you want?
Amen. I will hit him with our ask of the week. Our ask of the week is, whatever platform you're listening on, go rate us, please. Go give us a 5-star rating and a review. And also, if you've already done that, here's a little twist. Send this episode to a friend. If you got value out of this, if you thought it was interesting, if it helped you, or if it you think it'll help someone you know, just send it to a text. You don't got to share it on Facebook. You can just send it through a text or Messenger or whatever to a friend. Anything like that can really help us out. So if you guys could rate, comment, share with a friend, we would truly appreciate it.
We really would. And that's a great one, Hen. I love it. I don't know what we got next week, but we'll have something because that's what we do around here.
Oh, we have.
Oh, no, we do. Yes, yes.
I'm going to butcher this. Let me just look it up. We have Mr. Habits. This is a guy that I found through a podcast group I'm in. Master Your Motivation. Believe so that you can achieve. And he quit drinking. That's not the primary focus of his show, but he is something like a life coach that helps people
change behavior, yeah.
Change behaviors and start little habits to improve their life. So I think that'll be pretty cool and bring a lot of value, whether you're an addict or not.
Yeah, it's been. It, you guys aren't going to want to miss that one, where you're going to have someone super intelligent on a topic sit here and talk to us and listen to Henry and I sit and try to do the same. So
talk about dicks and farts.
Well, all right, dude. Then I'll see you next week, same place, same time. And I will finish it like I always do. I love you, Hen, very much. What a great episode.
I love you too, Cam. And remember, get that freedom to be yourself and fuck what they think.
And be like Jesse, dude. That guy doesn't give a fuck about nothing, man. Later, dude. Oh, there you are.